Smart ass, hey.
You can't be serious, man. Yeah, man. You cannot be serious!
Yeah, no, I'll give you some. We're on.
Yes.
Now, go. Gone.
I'll let you sit down. Oh, you guys, I hope.
Right, are you ready?
So, what we do in life, Don, is we take people as we find them. I hope that's what people do to me, and I hope that's what people do. What are you doing?
Oh, the fuck. Oh, we're on, by the way.
Don't yeah, we're on, by the way. This is how this rolls. We've spoken to, I said 100, the Rocket says about 90 people since we've been doing this. And we like to speak to interesting people, or in other terms, people of interest. And we've spoken to many. This is not an expose into a person's life. This is an introspection into life's experiences. And I'm only just warming all this up to introduce our guest. He's a titan of industry. I think wouldn't be an exaggeration to say that. He's been part of a TV series where two actors have actually played him in different series. He's given, I'll tell you what he hasn't done since I've asked him to come in. He gave no instructions and no demands about what questions we ask him. And I think not many people would do that. We always usually have people say, oh, don't mention this. He has given none of those. He's leaving it to us to be respectful and sensible about what we speak to him about, because he is genuinely a person of interest. His reputation probably precedes him, but as a review in a book said, he's had a book written about him. As a review in a book said, the bloke who read the book said this. It shows, it was a great read. It shows more about the person he is rather than what people try and portray him as. Now, we're not trying to massage him or make him anything that he's not, but he's a very welcome guest here, and he's, I'd like to say he's a friend of mine. I'm an acquaintance of his, and he is Dominic Gatto, better known as Mick. Mick, welcome to You Cannot Be Serious.
Thanks, Sam.
First question I'd like to ask. Don owes me a little bit of money. Could you assist me in getting it back
for him? No problem. I'll go up in the boot.
Now, listen, Mick, why were you so late getting here? Where have you been?
Mate, because I got wrong instructions.
Where
someone
from?
Told me you had Lorimer Street. Yeah.
No, I did. I
gave Eddie McGuire told me 8 Lorimer Street.
Eddie McGuire?
No, I gave Mick the wrong instructions, Don. What can I? Not speaking into it?
Now Mick, you're going to go first, are you?
I was going to ask.
Why are you doing this interview, Mick?
Oh, look, I'll be honest with you. I get chased by reporters and God knows what. Actually, someone emailed me yesterday, asked me if I wanted to go about your life. They follow you around and all that sort of thing. What's the
documentary?
Not a documentary, but like a real life thing, like it's on TV, Brother.
Reality, reality show.
Yeah, I couldn't think of that myself.
So I get approached all the time. I knock everyone back. I'll be honest. I've got no reason to talk to any media, or whatever, because they always portray me negatively. It's never positive. So I've taken a stance the last few years that I don't talk to anyone, don't do anything.
You did one with Sylvester, John Sylvester?
Not in the last few years, but I like John. He's always been pretty fair. But you asked me a question why I'm doing this, and I'll answer it. Sam's done a few things for me. And when I say a few things for me, I'll clarify, because I don't want anyone thinking he's done the wrong thing. But I've asked him to sort of mention fighters that we've had in the boxing game, on the footy show and whatever, and he has done that. And whatever I've ever done with Sam, whatever he's ever said he's going to do, he's done. And I respect him for that, because a lot of other people in his area, they say something and they don't do it. So anyway, I'm obligated to the man, and he asked me if I was interested in coming on to do this for him. And I said, mate, I'll do anything you like for me. So.
Well, Mick, yeah. I appreciate that. It says, it's well documented, your life, and we're not going through
unfortunately.
No, but Mick, everyone's life is well documented. Mine is, his is, Don's over there. It says in your CV, it says you're a businessman, a mediator, a debt collector, and an event promoter. Who are you?
Mate, I'm a family man. I'm a grandfather of five, and that's all I sort of really do in my life. That's all I worry about these days. But look, I do a bit of fight promoting, Sam. I do a bit of mediating. I look after a few builders. There's probably a dozen builders that I look after. I do their IR.
What's IR?
Well, their industrial relations stuff. What I do is a lot of builders won't deal with unions. I've got a very good affiliation with all the unions, the CFMEU and all of them. And I act as a buffer. They pay me a retainer. The union never stop their jobs. If there's a problem, they ring me up and they say, okay, Mick, you know, the C-bus hadn't been paid, or there's not a pie machine in the men's room or whatever. I fix the problem up for them. The union don't stop their jobs. They don't lose productivity. And
so how have you built up a rapport with the unions then?
It's been over the last 30 years I've sort of had a lot to do with them, and I've built this relationship and this respect that we've got. And, you know, I help them really just as much as they help me, because they want something done, it gets done. Yeah, builders don't get their job stopped, they're happy, they don't lose productivity, so everyone's happy.
So what's the art of mediation, Mick? What's your art of mediation?
Mate, look, I find that with mediation or debt collecting or things of that nature, that both parties walk away with a sour taste in their mouth, but they're happy. You know, you try and find the common ground that people are going to be happy with, and once you reach that common ground, you know, you settle things pretty quickly and everyone moves on.
Now, you're an intimidating man, Mick. You intimidate me, so I presume that's probably just at first glance a bonus when you wander into an office or a meeting. People just are on their guard.
Yeah, unfortunately, I have got that stigma.
Is it a stigma?
It is a stigma because, look, a lot of people I meet from interstate and whatever, I get driven mad for photos and autographs and all that sort of stuff. And Sam's been putting up with that all his life, so he knows exactly where I'm coming from. And once I sit down with someone and take a photo or whatever and have a chat or whatever, they just say, mate, I can't believe that you like this. You know, I thought you were completely different. I'm not trying to put tickets on myself, but I'm not the man they portray I am. I like to treat people the way they treat me. I heard Sam mention that before, and I've tried to bring my children up the same way, that if someone treats you with respect, you treat them with respect tenfold. If they want to go the other way, well, treat them the same. And I'm a firm believer of that.
Now, the Sporting Globe many years ago said this of you, Mick. Mick Gatto is the Paul Newman of the fight game. Women are after him like ants after honey. This is still the quote. At 6 foot two, he's a Greek god. He's more like a movie star. Well, in fact, you're not Greek. Your roots and Calabria. Heritage are from Calabria.
Yes. The south of Italy.
And is that where you met Mrs. Gatto at the fight game, or was that
she? My wife Cheryl at a nightclub in Swanson Street called Peanuts, and I'm sure you
yes,
know.
Yeah, absolutely.
And actually, me and two or three of my very dearest friends all met our wives there. So it's quite unbelievable, and we're all still friends today, and it's just unbelievable. Yeah.
So you were a boxer, Mick.
I was. Yeah, I had 9 fights. My first 5 fights, I won.
You won four, didn't you?
4 of them.
Yeah.
And then the last 4, I lost 2 or 3. I can't remember what the record was, but the last 4 were all comebacks, and they used to put posters up of me calling me the Italian Stallion and things of that nature. And on the top, they'd put Big Mick is back again. So
why did you retire each time?
I got involved in the gambling scene. My trainer, Kevin Mortison at the time, was involved in the illegal 2-up game in Melbourne. They used to run that, and that was above the gymnasium where I trained. And I noticed a lot of people going up all the time, and you know, been inquisitive and been a sticky nose. I found out that it was a gambling club, and one thing led to another. I ended up going up there and getting involved and starting to work there, and I ended up a partner there. So I run it for 20 years, 25 years.
So
was that in opposition to Nappy?
Nappy Ollington, yeah. I was a partner there with them.
Was that the same two-up
game? Yep. Same two-up, yeah.
Now, Mick, I've just read a book called Against the Odds about Alan Tripp.
Oh, yeah, he's a good mate of mine, Alan. Alan.
Well, because you were mentioned in the book. He became the biggest SP bookie in the world. He turned over.
I used to SP myself. And
you what?
I used to be an SP bookmaker myself. I got convicted of it. Anyway, Alan Tripp was, I was doing a fair bit of business with him them days. And he was one charge away from being locked up.
He was.
He and I'd been raided a few times, but he was raided numerous times. And I think the next time the judge told him he was going to jail him. And I don't know if it was his brother-in-law, Peter Bartholomew, or Bob Hawke at the time, because he was pretty close to him, that advised him to go to
Vanuatu,
and they never looked back. And he deserves everything he's got. He's an absolute gentleman. I love him.
It's an extraordinary book, that. Very well written by Nicola Garvey, I think her name is.
Yeah.
Can't remember what her name, but an excellent read.
I did read it.
Now Mick, go ahead.
I'd just like to get back to your boxing, because it was in the 70s. There weren't too many heavyweights in Australia back in the 70s.
There wasn't a lot, I'll be honest. I had two or three fights, and I was just rated number two in Victoria, so that gives you an idea of there wasn't a lot around. My trainer loved me. He believed that I was going to be the next Ali. He had people that he trained, like Frankie Ropers and what's his name? Anyway, he had a lot of top fighters there, and Rocky Mattioli, I was thinking of.
Oh, shit, did he have Mattioli?
Yeah, he closed his gym down on two or three occasions just to train me at his house, one-on-one, because he reckons I was the next
Ali.
Next great heavyweight, you know. But I used to break his heart all the time because I stopped training, you know.
Why, because you're not dedicated or just couldn't care or what?
I wasn't dedicated because I was running around nightclubs. I was up all night in the gambling venues, you know, running illegal games. And then out drinking, you know, women and God knows what
you
I mean.
Chasing
hang
skirt.
On, hang on.
How can you do it?
Yeah, right.
Very hard to be dedicated, and it's a sport.
Because you're 6 foot what? 6 foot two?
6 1 and a half.
Oh, yeah. What weight did you come in at? What weight?
I was always super heavyweight. I was always over 90 kilos, 90, 100. I'm actually under.
What, were you quick now, or did you have a punch?
Sorry?
Were you quick?
I was pretty quick for my size, I guess, and I did have a big punch, yeah. I did.
Rocky Mattioli was just an untapped. Well, not untapped, because he went to Italy and he became a world champion. But I remember him on TV ringside. I think he came from Latrobe Valley.
And he did, from Morwell.
Yeah, and his first couple of fights were I shouldn't swear. but he was really well cut. He was just. He was a machine, wasn't he? He had everything.
A good Italian following. I'm quite close to Rocky even now.
Is he still in Italy?
He's in Italy. He lives there. He never had a tattoo on his body until he's 55 or something. He's covered in them now. He looks like Toby Mitchell. He's not that bad, but he's got them all over him anyway. But he's a lovely bloke.
He was an unbelievable when he started. Yeah. He was one of the shining lights on TV
big
rings.
Following. Like. He used to pack festival halls. Oh. You know, there'd be 5,000 fans there.
Yeah. Now, Mega, to be fair to say, you didn't go on with the boxing career because you weren't focused, you were chasing skirt. You were a heartthrob amongst the fairer sex, Mick.
I don't know about that.
No, I do know about that.
Look, I was sidetracked, I'll be honest. I do regret it. I regret a couple of things. I regret that I never fought amateur, because most fighters fight amateur before they fight professional.
Why is that a regret?
I walked into a boxing gym off the street and I just started training and end up fighting professionally straight away, which is pretty rare, you know.
But why is it a regret not being an amateur?
Because being an amateur teaches you all the proper skills and all that, and you gain that experience. And whatever, when you turn professional, you've got that experience under your belt, and it's a big plus.
Now, Mick, we're warming you up. This is not going to go
Or the whole interview like this, we're going to ask you about some of the more...
Let me tell you something before you ask me anything. Piranha would pay anything to be part of this interview. They've been asking me questions.
But they've wound them up.
Talk to anyone.
These are very harmless questions, Mick, and they're all going to be harmless, but we're going
to... ask you whatever you like.
Were you here when I said not many people don't put restrictions, particularly people of interest, and I really appreciate you not saying to me about the questions. So, and for that respect, we'll pay equal respect to you. Now, Mick, you've had a book written about you called I, Mick Gatto by Tom Noble. Was it fair? Was it authorised by you? Did he speak to you about it? And what did you get out of that, if anything?
Look, the book was something that I was forced to do, and the reason I say why I was forced to do it because there was an Underbelly series at the time that I featured in myself, the Underworld Wars and all that, and the company that produced it was a company called Screen Time. A bloke called Des Monahan was the producer. I met with him several times during all this Underbelly stuff. He told me that they were going to do a movie about me, about what information they had in the public sector, police and what have you. And he gave me an option. He said, either you go write a book or we'll just do a movie of what we know. So anyway, I went and spoke to a few lawyers, spoke to a few close friends, spoke to my family, my wife and all that. And everyone was of the opinion that I probably should write a book and be in charge of my own destiny to a certain extent, because otherwise they're going to portray me as a drug dealer or this, that and the other, and it's one thing I'm anti. And it would have caused havoc if I had done that, because I'd probably be doing 30 years jail. But anyway, so I was forced to do this book, and Tom Noble ghost wrote it. And when I say ghost wrote it, I used to have a house in Lower Plenty that had an inside gymnasium and a big ring inside the house, and there used to be three or four of us that used to train there every morning. And when we finished training, we'd go and sit outside and have a coffee and salami and a cognac and whatever. And Tom Noble used to come and he used to sit there and he used to ask us all questions. And obviously he recorded it. All. Thank you, Sam. And he ended up ghostwriting this book. And then when it came to sort of publishing it, I showed it to Robert Richter and a few different people to make sure that wasn't going to cause myself any grief, and he let me, you know, go through it all and change whatever I wanted to change and add whatever I wanted to add and whatever, and that's how the book came about.
We'll get on to Robert Richter in a minute, shortly, but of all the things I've read about you, Mick, there's not one mention of drugs. I hear you just said then you're anti-drugs.
Yeah, I've been all my life. Yeah.
And that's...
It's the only reason I'm still alive, Sam.
Because you always never got involved in either the importation or the distribution or taking them yourself?
No, I had plenty of offers, I've got to be honest, over the years, and you know, I've thrown people out of the two-up for that simple reason that have asked me, you know, said, you know, get heroin or whatever. I said, mate, piss off. Get out the joint, don't come back here again. It's just something that...
It'd be well to take your advice, Mick.
Yeah.
Yep.
Something I'm not interested in, and you know, I really believe that the government should hurry up and do something about it, because the way this country's going, I feel sorry for our grandchildren. It's just terrible what's happening, and if they don't address it in some way soon, it's going to be havoc.
You mentioned there you're still alive because you didn't deal in drugs. So the gangland wars were based on drugs?
Look, it probably was, because, you know, Carl Williams got shot because he owed the Morans $400,000, so it goes. And from there he, you know, planned and executed them all, and that's how it all started.
What, from Carl Williams and his retribution or retaliation?
Yeah, you know, they made a big mistake. They should have killed him.
But there have been 20-odd people killed over it.
Sorry?
20-odd people killed over it?
Well, I don't agree with the 20-odd people killed over it. They just throw extra names in and just to make it more spicy and whatever, and it's not quite the way it's they say it is, you know. Even, you know, the movie Underbelly and whatever, about 80% of it's not true. You know, it's all pumped up for
they took a bit of license.
Commercial,
commercial. It's all pumped up, and it's not quite the way it is.
What about the tactics Piranha is being wound up? It was set up in, I think, early 2000s to investigate the gangland wars. Do you think their tactics? What did you think of their tactics, Piranha, as far as trying to curb this gangland war?
I didn't think their tactics were any good at all. In fact, you know, if they wanted to, they could have cleaned it up overnight. I mean,
in what way?
Well, I'll tell you, it's simple. I mean, once Piranha started, and it was when Jason Moran got killed at that Auskick thing with 200 kids there and whatever, there was huge public outcry, and that's how Piranha started. Simon Overland, who he's no friend of mine, I don't like the bloke. They knew who the targets were. They had a big whiteboard in Piranha that had all the targets on it. Lewis Moran, Graham Kinnambara, me. You know, there was 15 names there, 10 names or whatever. I mean, all the police had to do was saturate, you know, surveillance on them people. And they could have avoided the executions. They could have stopped it all. And people would have been charged and locked up. But unfortunately, and I'll say it publicly, I don't really care. Once it's criminals killing criminals, they don't care. They just sit in the fence and let it happen until, you know, someone from the public or something like that gets hurt or involved or whatever. That's when things change, and it's proven with the Auskick thing. So, you know, they just sit back and let it go. So they could have cleaned it up, and I believe, and it'd be people, friends of mine still alive today if they'd done that. And I'm a bit dirty on it, I'll be honest.
Now, this might be a naive question, Mick, but if the gangland war was mainly about drugs and you weren't involved in drugs, how were you implicated or involved in it? Were you asked to step in and try and bring it to a head or a mediate it or
no,
what?
I sat on the fence and observed. I mean, I knew most of the players. Most of them were friends of mine anyway. And I just sat back and watched it like everyone else. But I had a meeting with Veneman and Carl Williams, and I told them, I said, I don't care what yous do. I said, as long as you don't touch Graham, the monster, who was a very close friend of mine. And they wanted to kill Lewis Moran, his kids and whatever, and Graham used to be quite friendly with them, very close to him. So I made it clear to him that I've got nothing against anyone. I've got nothing to do with any of this. I said, but if you kill Graham, you're going to have a problem with me.
Which they did.
Which they did, yeah.
And
that's
then
how I got involved.
And what did you, after you had sort of given that declaration or warning and it was ignored, if you like, what action did you take then, Mick?
I met up with them at the casino. They wouldn't meet in Carlton. Too weak to come to Carlton. But anyway, we met at the casino and the whole world was watching us. And he denied having any involvement in that, Carl. And Veneman did too. It wasn't us. And
I
couldn't prove that it wasn't them, but yep. I believe deep in my heart it was. I become very careful and, you know, making sure that I wasn't the next one to get killed and whatever.
And how do you do that, Mick? How do you be very careful? Do you have a very big security contingent?
Yeah,
and,
look, you know, I've always been security conscious all my life, ever since I was a kid. I've always had, you know, cameras and alarms and carried a gun and whatever. I've used whatever security measures I've had to use. And fortunately, I should say, you know, I just had to keep an eye on my rearview mirror all the time. And wherever I went, I was always very careful who I met and
so
where I went. You know?
I presume you wouldn't be saying you carried a gun unless you had a license for it. Did you have a license?
No, I used to carry a gun because...
Just
in
protection?
Years, the two up and all that, everyone carried guns.
I see, yep.
And it was like mobile phones today. Everyone's got a mobile phone. Well, them days, everyone had a gun. And I used to carry a lot of large amounts of money from the two up and all that. You know, I've carried guns many a time. Not in recent times, but years ago I did, yeah.
Now, this is so... you spent 18 months in... Incarcerated?
I think it was 15.
15?
15 months, yeah.
While you were waiting about the Veneman trial?
That's right.
What did you... what was it like to spend 15 months in jail. Were you fairly confident of your safeguard in there personally, or just what was it like, Mick? We can't quite imagine it.
All right. I'll paint you a picture. Imagine being locked up in your bathroom for 23 hours a day. Well, that's what it was like. I was locked up in a room 8x6 or whatever it was. There was a little shower in there, a TV and a bed, and you couldn't swing a cat around that. So I was locked up in that room for 23 hours a day. I had no human contact with anyone. My wife and kids would come and see me and they'd be crying their eyes out through a glass window, screen. You know, that there was no human contact whatsoever. And that broke my heart, I've got to be honest. And the piranha monitored everything I'd done. They used to tip my cell up once a week, go through it with dogs, lock me up in another cell, and whatever I've written down or whatever information they could gain, they'd take, they'd photocopy everything, monitored all my calls, monitored all my visits. So look, it was really Hannibal Lecter stuff, I've got to be honest. You know, a couple of times I come out of the cell to go to a dentist, for argument's sake. So where I was at Barwon, it was a jail inside a jail.
Yep.
It was the same at Port Phillip. They built these $20 million super jails inside the jail. And anyway, if I wanted to go to see the dentist or whatever, what they'd do, they'd lock down the whole jail. You just got no idea, it's just unbelievable. They would shackle me up like a crab, you know, with shackles and all that. And six of them had marched me through to the dentist and no other prisoner could come near me. They were all locked up. You know, a couple of them would yell out that I knew from over fences or whatever. But I had no human contact with anyone, Sam. So, you know, that broke my heart, I've got to be honest. And that's how they got the results they got, by making people turn up, roll over.
Did you have the fear of... Did you almost go stir crazy? Did it actually affect you mentally to the stage where it nearly broke you or not? Or were you too strong for that?
It was never ever going to break me, I'll be honest. My mind's too strong for that. I mean, I've got my set ways and the way I've been brought up, and that's the way I'll die. And it was never ever going to happen. I was either going to die in there or whatever, but there was no chance of me ever rolling over or doing anything like that.
Did you fear for your life in there?
I did not. In fact, I had a meeting with the jail authorities and whatever, and I said, look, put me out in mainstream. Shackle me out in mainstream. So I don't care about anyone. So I'm not worried about anyone. I said, you know, if anyone wants to have a crack at me, and I said, I can handle myself. I said, but I've got no enemies as far as I'm concerned. You know, the bloke tried to kill me. And he finished off second best, what now, you know. But anyway, they said no. They said, we can't do that because you'd be putting our guards at risk if something happened. You'd be putting their lives at risk too. So unfortunately, I was stuck in this cell for 14 months or whatever it was, 23 hours a day with no human contact. And as far as being confident of beating this, Sam, when I first went in there, I was locked up 2 weeks. And Piranha came in and see me, and I got shackled, and they took me into this room. And they give me a letter from the Chief Commissioner. And I read this letter, and it said, you know, I'm officially barred from every casino and racecourse in Victoria, in Australia, for 10 years. So this built my hopes up. I thought, gee, 10 years, if I go down for this, I'm going to get 25. They've only barred me for 10. They must think I'm going to beat it. So I built my hopes up too. And anyway, as we all know, I ended up getting acquitted and I got out and they converted to life. But anyway, that's fine. I'm not worried about that.
So,
but I was very confident I was going to get out. I was.
Yeah, so Robert Richter must have, he did an adequate job because you were found not guilty.
Look, let me tell you, I love Robert Richter. He's one of the greatest advocates in this land. And he is a man that works 24 hours a day on cases. He thinks outside the box. He came in and seen me many times and he's telling me I'm worried about this or there's a problem with this or whatever. He used to put me up on tables and I'd stand up on the table and he'd interview me.
Stand up on a table?
Like, Yeah, I'd stand up in the table and he'd act like he's a prosecutor.
Rehearsing. Oh, rehearsing.
So we'd do all this mock stuff. And if I said the wrong thing, he'd go, crook at me, you know. Start yelling at me. I'd say, all right, Dad, you know, leave me alone. But he's just a beautiful man, you know. He really is. And it's not just me. It's with anyone that he acts for. He does his best to do the best he possibly can to get him acquitted or whatever, you know.
In your heart of hearts and his... Did you think you would beat the charge, and did he?
Look, let me tell you, he came down. I was at the Supreme Court just about to go to trial. He came down in the cell and he said to me, look, Mick, he said, I've got to tell you this. He said, Horgan, who was the prosecutor, he said, he's offered us a deal. I said, what's the deal? And he said, you plead guilty, they'll give you 5 years. I said, on paper? They said, yeah, on paper. And he said, I seriously think you should think about it. He said, because if you go down, you're going to get 25. And he said, I really think you should give it a bit of thought. I said, I have. And he said, well, what do you want to do? I said, Sydney or the bush, Robert. I said, I'm not pleading guilty to nothing.
That's extraordinary, man. Yeah. That is probably, you'd have more guts and courage to make that decision and put your life and the risk of incarceration for the rest of your life, ostensibly, that is an amazing amazing thing to say, Mick.
Well, I was confident that I'd be acquitted, you know, namely because it was only me and him in the room. The evidence proved that what I was saying was the truth. You know, I had, you know... gunshot residue and gun smoke, you know, yep, marks all over my suit that prove that, you know, we're fighting over a gun and a shot went past my head and whatever. You know, a lot of things that I said, everything was proven. The blood splatter, all them different things that come into account. So,
you will just answer this question if you want to, and you won't. If that's fine. That's the basis of this. How did you come to walk out the back with Veneman? Did he said, come out the back, Mick, I want to have a word, what?
Yeah, look, I used to be quite friendly with him. He used to come up and see me up in Carlton all the time, and he was forever getting himself in trouble in nightclubs and all that, and he knew I knew everyone, I'd be fixing things up for him all the time. We had that relationship. He really had a lot of time for me, and I had a lot of time for him. Although I knew he was a hired killer, and whatever that was, a rumours going around, although I had no...
evidence.
Real evidence of that, but everyone was saying that, and he was always tight-lipped. But anyway, any time he used to come and see me at La Porcello or any of them restaurants in Carlton, would always walk away and go and have a quiet chat somewhere either out the back or whatever. So on this particular day, he asked me, he said, can I have a chat to you? I said, do you want to get out the back or the front? Or he goes, yeah, we'll get the back. And that's what happened. We walked out there and had a chat, and one thing led to another, and
so he accused you of something and you took umbrage at it, or
I accused him.
I see, yep.
I accused him. Because I believed he killed Graham.
Yep.
My friend Graham. And
he was killed in the cemetery, wasn't he?
He was killed at the front of his house.
Oh, that's right. It's the other bloke was killed in the cemetery. Yeah. Sorry, yep.
He had a gun, he shot the bloke,
yep,
one of them in the shoulder.
Yep.
Anyway, long story short, so I put on Veneman. I said to him, you know, you killed my mate. And he said, why would I do that, Mick? You're a mate of mine. And I said, well, Dino Dibber and another bloke, I forget his name now, I said, they were childhood friends of yours and you killed them both. And he goes, they were fucking dogs. Excuse my language, sorry.
It's all right.
He goes, I should have put another clipping on, was his exact words, you know. And I just said, mate, you can't be trusted, mate. I don't want you in our company anymore. And all of a sudden, I remember, like it was yesterday, his eyes just spun. And he reached at the back of his pants. I didn't think anything of it. And he's pulled the gun out. And thank God I've grabbed hold of it.
Is he a big man?
He wasn't a big man. He was a fighter. He was a kickboxer. He was quite...
How tall?
He's only... like a jockey.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
He was small, man.
He was small, but he was very quick, very violent. go from you know, from one, go from being placid to very violent very quickly. You know, you just Dr. Jekyll, Dr. Hyde. So anyway, he pulled the gun out, and we've had this wrestling match over this gun, and shots have gone off everywhere, and I've sort of overpowered him. I've pushed the gun towards him, and I've just kept pulling the trigger with his finger on it and my finger on it. I just kept pulling the trigger. And, you know, five or six or eight shots went off. I don't know how many went off, and there was blood.
What
and
a just adrenaline just took over as far as you were concerned?
Exactly right. It was, you know, over my life or years, you know.
And you're a big man.
Yeah. Look, I was lucky that my probably my boxing you know.
Well, you worked out, didn't you?
I used to train a fair bit.
Yeah.
And after it, Mick, did you walk out and alert the authority? Or what did you
look,
do?
Look, I obviously pulled the gun out of his hand.
Yep.
And he was laying on the ground there, blood everywhere, and he was gurgling and all carrying on, whatever. And there was a few people out in the restaurant there. And
there was a lot at one stage, very few when you walked out, Mick.
Yeah, well, you're right. But anyway, I told the owner, I said, you better ring the police and the ambulance. Yep. He said, what happened? I said, I think I just killed him.
Yep.
Words that effect. He tried to kill me and I killed him. Anyway, next minute police come from everywhere and the rest is history. Huh?
Yep. Now, Mick, you said you made the decision not to accept 5 years and subsequently a very good decision. Did you contemplate how long did you think about what have I made that decision for? Because this is 25 years. Had you prepared yourself and your family and your friends and anyone else for 25 years incarcerated? Or didn't you think about it?
It was an instant retaliation, an instant response, because I was adamant I was going to be acquitted. I was adamant. I thought to myself, no jury, proper jury in this world could convict me. There was just too much doubt there. And with trials and whatever, I'm sure you all know, it's got to be, it has to be a majority decision.
Yep.
And there can be no, what's the word? Sorry?
Reasonable doubt.
Yes, thanks. There's got to be no reasonable doubt. Well, there was so much doubt in my case, it was just unbelievable. So I was very confident that I'd be acquitted.
Now, Mick, we appreciate you taking these questions and actually answering them. And you could have said you don't want to speak about it. We actually do appreciate it.
Could I
just ask you about, you went overseas for the famous or infamous Opus Prime retrieval. Yep. You went over as a debt collector. How did you come to go over there? That was very big news of the day.
What happened then? Me and a good mate of mine, John Currie, we do a lot of stuff together and travel overseas. We've done a few things overseas, but with this specific case, a couple of people come to us that got their fingers burnt with Opus Prime, whatever, and they were certain that there was two or three directors in Singapore that they had plenty of money. And they could recover their money, or we could recover their money for them. So they flew us over there, I don't know if it might have been first class or business class, I can't remember. And anyway, they paid all expenses and give us a fair bit of money up front and whatever. And the media at the time, there was a lot of media at the airport when we arrived there. Someone leaked it to them that we were going over there for Opus Prime, and they were jumping out the trees. And I remember they reported saying they'll go over there and they won't get any money and they won't get to any directors and it'll be just a big waste of time. So when we landed in Singapore, there was another big team of reporters there. Anyway, long story short, we ended up contacting the directors who were in Hong Kong at the time. They flew from Hong Kong to Singapore to come and see us. We had a big meeting in an office with a big whiteboard.
It was Mr. Moog.
Sorry?
Was that Mr. Moog?
It was.
Yep.
And I got a couple of age reporters to come in there and witness the whole thing because they were saying that we wouldn't get to them. And they put up on the whiteboard exactly where the money went, where it was, There was no money there. There's, you know, some cars and different things, but and we reported back to the people we were working for. They were very happy with that. They were very happy that we got to them. Very happy that there wasn't a lot of money there in the Virgin Islands and whatever. And we'd done our job.
What was the art of debt collecting over there, Mick? Just to have a genuine convivial chat to Mr. Moog and say, "Now look, old son, I think you better just give us something back." Or is that basically how it went, or did you come in a little heavier than that?
We didn't come in heavy, but we just told them, look, you know, these people are acting for, they owed a lot of money, and if the money's there, we want it. And like I said, they were in Hong Kong, and they were absolutely petrified. I said, jump in the plane and come over here. So now that's what they'd done. They flew over, and we sat down and had this in-depth chat. And they put it all up on the whiteboard where everything was and whatever. And actually, we...
So did you get the money? You got some money out of them, did you?
We didn't get any money, no. We didn't get any money, but we got all the information that all the liquidators would have taken them probably 2 or 3 years to get. We got it from in a weekend or whatever. So we obviously done a lot of work, a lot of assistance to the liquidators and whatever.
And what was Opus... I don't know. What's Opus Prime?
It was people... investing in like share market and different things and futures and whatever, and there was hundreds of millions.
520 million they dotted the creditors for.
Yeah, there was hundreds of millions that have gone missing, and you know, so no one knew where it went.
Well, Mick, you've done it on both sides of the fence. Can you tell me the difference, or what's your opinion of blue collar crime and white collar crime?
Blue collar crime and white collar.
Well. White collar crime being the business, you know, the top end of town, and what they get away with, the blue financial. Collar, you know, all of that
murder
stuff.
And that financial deception, as opposed to murder and physical.
When you say, what do you mean? What's the difference?
Is there a difference?
Well, of course there is. I mean, blue collar crime, it's really criminal. Look, more criminal than white collar.
Is it? Is it?
Well, it sort of is. You know, white collar crime. You know, I mean.
A lot of people get hurt,
but it's
It's like Bernie Madoff.
It's not as bad as going out killing someone or belting someone to pieces or whatever. I think there's a big difference. You know, white collar crimes, purely financial. Blue collar crimes,
physical.
Physical.
But Bernie Madoff, dudded the Ponzi scheme in America, dudded his clients for $60 billion. I reckon he's just about as guilty as someone who murders someone.
And he probably lives the best, highest life in the world.
He probably does, Mick. Yeah. Now,
but
now
look,
do you
it comes back on him. The wheel goes round, it catches up with
karma.
100%.
Now, Mick, have you had anything to do with the Norm Gallagher and the BLF or the CFMEU, or are you involved in their dealings? And did you have an opinion of Grollo? Did you try and get Grollo out of the shit, or did you have a chat to him about what's going on? Mick?
Norm Gallagher, I was in jail with him in 1982. I unfortunately went to jail for a year. And
for what?
I used to cut safes open at the time and turn alarms off and all that sort of thing.
No, fair enough, Mick, but, yep.
You know, it was just my choice to work at the
just a hobby, yep.
I loved it, to be honest. And
yep.
Anyway,
good
never
point.
Hurt anyone, but anyway, so I ended up doing a year. And he was in the garden. He had the cushy job of looking after the governor's garden. So, you know, we sort of chatted a bit. You know, I was only there 3 months and I got sent to Morwell. I didn't mind Norm. But Setka...
Yep.
Who's in charge of the CFMEU now? I've been involved with him for many, many years. And
convivially?
Sorry?
Friendly or...
Very friendly.
Yes, John Setka.
And I believe that someone of his calibre, or even Peter Marshall, who's a very dear friend of mine, he's in charge of the Firefighters Union, I believe that someone of that calibre should be running the country. And I'll tell you for why.
A John Setka, for example?
Yep, I'll tell you for why. Because they've got the interests of the people at heart, not the money. You know, Setka could earn billions of dollars. He won't be swayed. No one can corrupt him. No one can, you know, give him money to do something. He just won't do it. And I can tell you that firsthand because I've tried.
He won't be bribed. Sort of he won't be. You can't buy him.
But if you can help do something for the men or whatever, or get them better conditions, or do this, mate, he'll jump off a building to sort of do it. You know, he's just a beautiful bloke that way. Dean Miles, another one that comes to mind, that used to be in charge of the Crane Union, I think it was. The ETU, I think it was. He's another bloke that fits that calibre also. He had the interests of the people at heart, and they're just beautiful people. So anyway, through Setka and all that sort of stuff, I've met all the organisers, all the shop stewards and all that I'm involved with. I know most of them. When this Grollo saga happened, I did meet up with Grollo's main man, who was a bloke called John Van Camp. And John Van Camp used to be in charge of the Crane Union. He was a unionist, and he ended up jumping ship and going working for Grollo. A lot of the unionists were howling dirty on him because he sort of jumped the fence, but he was offered a big deal and plenty of money, and anyway, it's his business. I met up with him, and I brought John Setka to a quiet meeting in a restaurant upstairs.
With the Grollo people? Yes, with this man? Yes.
Setka was Grollo, and John Van Camp was Grollo's construction manager worldwide. So it was me, him and Setka had a meeting, right? Anyway, it was agreed that certain things were going to happen, that they'll put on a shop steward, they'll do this, they'll do that, everything will be swept under the carpet and life goes on. It was all agreed, we all shook hands, whatever. Anyway, a couple of days later, there was an article in the paper that said that it never happened, it weren't true, and it was Van Camp saying, you know, that wasn't a deal and whatever, and he was just telling lies, you know, but I got a little bit dirty with him. I never spoke to him for a few years, but we're mates again now. But look, I could have fixed that up.
And is it beyond, it's beyond redemption now, beyond...
Oh, mate, I think so. I think Bruno Grollo, for argument's sake, had a really good relationship with the unions and all that, and they all loved him, his men loved him, and they all worked in harmony. And I mean, if there was a problem, they fixed it. But the son, he took a different stance. He wanted to, you know, go with the
Buck
government
the
and all that. And because a lot of the government jobs and whatever, they won't give to EBA union people, they give them to non-EBA people. So Daniel Grollo probably thought, I'll stick with the government and I'll get all their work and bugger the union, they'll be out of business and whatever. And he picked the wrong horse.
Now, Mick, it feels like we've been speaking to you for just 5 minutes, but we've probably been too long. I have got just two more questions to ask you.
Okay.
What is the Carlton Crew? I think I came up into your office up in there. Were you in Lygon Street? Is that where the office was? You had a restaurant there, didn't you?
Oh, I was there all the time, wasn't I?
Anyhow, I don't know. Yeah. What is the Carlton Crew?
The Carlton Crew was invented by the media.
Invented?
It was invented by the media and the police. I used to run around with the bloke 80 years old at the time, and every day I was with him. And if that was a Carlton, I'd tell you what, God help us, you know. But look, I was friendly with all these people that they nominated, were all part of the Carlton Crew, like Lewis Moran, his sons, and Graham and all that. You know, they made a big group saying they're all the Carlton Crew, and I don't know if you've seen Underbelly, we all met in the Carlton football ground. Well, I've never been to the Carlton football ground in my life. Anyway, it was all just made up. TV.
Yep. But why wouldn't Carl Williams and Benji Benjamin meet you in Carlton?
Benjamin?
What Benjamin?
Because
Benjamin?
They knew that it would be on my terms. They probably thought I'd kill him. And they knew at the casino there's 5,000 cameras there watching us that there wouldn't be a problem. And that's why I think most of the people, including myself, have been barred from the casino, because a lot of people go there, government and whatever, and they probably don't want to be in a position that one day something silly is going to happen. You know, so that's why I believe that a lot of people have been barred from there for that reason.
Hey,
but that was a reason they wanted to meet there, because of their security, they'd be safe there. You know?
Now, Mick, they might just embark on some reverse psychology, the casino. Mm-hmm. You are, whether you like it or not, or people like it or not, you are an identity. You'd be might be a draw card. People might flock to the casino just to rub shoulders with Dominic Gatto.
Mate, they couldn't get me back there for millions of dollars, mate. They've done me the biggest favour of my life. I've got to tell you a quick story, quickly. You'll like this. At the time when I got barred, it was Christine Nixon that barred me. Yeah? So anyway, when I got out of jail, I go to a function one night, and she's there with her husband, and I walk in, and she says, Mr. Gatto, what are you doing here? I said, same thing you're doing here. I said, I I've been trying to get your address. And she says, why? I said, because I was going to send you a diamond ring. And she goes, why would you do that? I said, because I've never been in a better position since you barred me from the casino and all the race courses. I said, you've really done me a big favour. I wanted to thank you. Burst out laughing, called her husband over, John, tell him what you just told me. Anyway, they both burst out laughing. I said, it's true. I said, you've done me the biggest favour of my life. I want to thank you very much.
Are you, now, you've suffered some personal tragedy in your life?
I have, yeah.
Your son?
Yeah, he committed suicide, unfortunately.
And how did...
I don't often talk about him with anyone, but look, he was, he had mental health problems. He was a beautiful boy. I miss him every day. I've got to be honest, I go, it's not a day goes by I don't think about him, I'll be honest. I used to be with him all the time. And look, he got involved in drugs and...
Did he?
Unfortunately, yep. Yeah, he was on the ice and all that. And
did you know that?
I knew when I got out of jail, I knew.
Yep.
And we'd sent him to probably half a dozen rehabs all around the world. The last time was in Bali, and we really believe that he came good. We really believe that he was cured, and so did he. And one thing led to another. He went to a nightclub, and anyway, someone obviously offered it to him, and he became hooked on it again. And he used to tell me, he said, Dad, I've had enough. I can't handle this. He said, he's not going to jump off a balcony. I said, don't be so stupid. You know? He says, you got no idea, Dad. These voices in my head. He says, you got no idea. Anyway, one night he done it. So,
yeah. And I'm going to be a bit pointless saying this, but it knocked you about. Did you think, I don't know, was there anything you thought you might have been able to do? Because if people get it in their mind, I suppose.
Look, unfortunately, you know, it's something that we'll never get over. And you always think, if I'd done this or if I'd done that or whatever. But look, he was adamant that he wanted to take his life, that he had enough. He would have done it one way or another. If it wasn't then, it would have been tomorrow. It would have been next week. You know, he had it in his mind. He just couldn't handle life anymore. And he couldn't put it.
Nick, can I go back to boxing again?
Yep.
The reason I go back to boxing is that they're, you know, even in the this concussion thing that's happening in football, I think, you know, one sport that it, you know, should be looked at is boxing. What do you think with regard to CTE and boxing?
Look, I believe that anything they can do to help people with prevent brain injuries and things of that nature, I think would be a big plus. You know, I mean, the guidelines they've got at the moment, doctors and ECGs and EEGs they have before they fight and whatever, is unbelievable, you know. So they've got plenty of stuff that they've been doing for years to prevent all this or try and stop it or whatever. And look, I agree with it all. I do. I think that whatever they can do to prevent people getting brain injuries or getting hurt in sport, it's a big plus.
I learned boxing there for a while I was playing, I was trained. And some of the people, they were, you know, the older blokes that had fought, they, you know, it was called punchy.
Yeah, look, I know a lot of fighters and I believe they're affected by it. There's no doubt about it. Look, I only had 9 fights. I remember once I fought at Festival Hall, I knocked the bloke out. I was sitting in the audience, gloved up with a dressing gown on, and my trainer walked by and I said, when am I fighting, Kevin? He goes, you all right? I said, no. I said, when am I fighting? He goes, you just knocked the bloke out. I said, did I? So, you know, I got hit in the head with one and got concussed. So, you know, I had no recollection of that fight. So, look, you know, you can get hurt and people that fight too long and they stay there for too long, you know, they're going to be affected.
Mick, I said this would only go for a certain... Mick, I tell you what, I don't think I've had a better experience speaking to someone who I don't really know, and I'm sure most people don't, and whatever people think of you or me or Don or anyone in life, it's how you find people. And I tell you what, mate, I really appreciate you coming and doing this. You didn't have to answer any of these questions. You didn't put any restrictions on us. And for that, I really do thank you, mate. And you have my appreciation.
Sam, like I said, I've always had plenty of respect for you. And it's an absolute pleasure if I can help you, mate, anytime. Thanks very much. Sorry about that. With the...
around the streets late at night, I'm worried because